Welcome back to the Ghost Bunny Podcast. I'm your host, Bridget Marcourt, with a brand new episode for you guys. My guest today is Troy Taylor. Troy Taylor is the author of more than 150 books on history, hauntings, true crime, the unexplained, and the supernatural in America. All of my favorite topics. He is the founder of American Hauntings, Inc., which offers books, events, and ghost tours, and is the owner of the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. He is also the writer and co-host of the American Hauntings podcast. He has appeared in numerous television shows and documentaries, and his book about the St. Louis exorcism of 1949 is currently under option to be turned into a film by a major production company. That's so exciting. Let's chat with him. Troy, thank you so much for doing the show today.
Oh, absolutely. You know, all you had to do was ask, and here I am. That's how it works.
Well, first I wanted to say congratulations, because I was just reading in your bio that the St. Louis exorcism is going to like major production possibly.
Well, fingers crossed. They've had it for a while, but I know that there is, and of course, I'm not allowed to say who it is. You know how that goes. But yeah. There is a director and there is a script. So it's getting closer. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. So I know the last time I had you on my podcast, we talked about that a little bit, but can you just tell listeners who may not have heard that or don't know about it a little bit of the history of that? Oh, and before we get started, let me just say my camera is being glitchy. It's not paranormal. I am ordering a new one today because I was trying to determine if it was like our internet or my camera or my computer, like which element it was, and it's definitely my camera, so I'm gonna get that fixed. So if I'm glitching, that's why. One other thing, I have two cats that decided right now is the time to be wild behind me. Yeah. So if you see the ghosts move or the blinds move or something moving behind me, it's not paranormal either. It is my cats being jerks right now.
Well, they always do. I mean, that's what they do as soon as the cameras come on. Otherwise, you can't find them all day until you don't need them around, and then here they are.
Yes,
so that's how it always is.
Extra rambunctious right now.
Of course they are. Of course they are.
Besides that, tell us about the St. Louis exorcism.
The Exorcist, the film that it, and the book that everybody knows about, William Peter Blatty did, was inspired by a couple of different cases from American history that were believed to be genuine demonic possessions. The most famous one was one that happened in 1949 in St. Louis. And that's kind of the one that the legend has kind of evolved from. But it started with a young kid in a Washington, D.C. suburb, right outside of the city, and began having what we'd probably think of today as poltergeist activity in his home. And that's how it started. And it kept up and it kept increasing. There was a Lutheran minister who got involved, who witnessed a lot of their strange happenings, but he also believed that it was just could be something explained by a, you know, this boy with maybe some energy, you know, poltergeist activity, and never really thought too much more about it. But as things began to increase, the family decided to go to St. Louis, where they were originally from, and stay with some family members there. But what started as possibly an infestation by some sort of malevolent force turned into a full-blown possession. At least that's what everyone believed, from the family to the priests who were involved to the archbishop of the church. I mean, they ordered an actual exorcism. It started in the house where the relatives lived. It moved to a couple of other places, and it ended up in a Alexian Brothers hospital in St. Louis. And so he was being attended by monks and by priests, and the whole thing went on for about 6 weeks. And it was believed to be genuine. There was a report that was filed when it was over. There were 48 witnesses who signed affidavits saying that they had witnessed the activity and believed it to be real. But the church decided not to pursue it any further. They decided to keep everything very quiet for a number of different reasons. One, they had a professor who investigated who thought it was inconclusive. They also didn't want to embarrass the boy or his family, so they wanted to keep his name under wraps. And so it was always the exorcism of Roland Doe. That's how they always listed it. And they also just decided that it, you know, that no good could come of this in the climate of St. Louis at the time, when the church was trying to desegregate all of their churches and schools. And so there was a lot going on where they decided to keep this thing quiet. And it remained that way all the way up until 2020, when the boy who was allegedly possessed passed away. Now, years before, I started on this project back in the late 90s, and I wrote my first book about it in 2006, but there was a lot I couldn't say because I had interviewed not only the boy, but family members, relatives, every living priest involved, one of the monks who was still alive, who was at the hospital, everybody that was still alive I had interviewed, but I had always promised him that I would keep his name to myself for as long as he lived. That was our agreement when he did the interview. And he passed away from a stroke in 2020. And then the following year, I put out a new edition of the book and put in everything that I could talk about that I hadn't been able to talk about before. So Roland Doe became Ronald Hunkler because that was his real name. And I was able to fill in a lot of his biographical information. And I felt had a lot more compelling evidence than I'd ever been able to present before. So that's always been, you know, probably, well, it's definitely the best-selling book I've done. But I do presentations and lectures on it at least once a month. But then the book got picked up by a production company and a studio. And so we'll see. Hopefully it'll get turned into an actual movie, which is kind of funny because it's a book about a story that inspired a book that inspired a movie. And now the original thing is now inspiring a movie. So it makes your head hurt when you think about it too much. Right. But anyway,
you know. Also, didn't they, I forget if it was Discovery Plus or something, didn't they do like a shock doc about it as well?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that actually, we filmed that weirdly. That was filmed in May of 2020 at the height of the pandemic. Everything was closed. And they were on a schedule, and I had to go to a production company in St. Louis, and no one was allowed to, remember, this is May, so we don't know what's going on with COVID at this point. No one could go in the studio with me. So I had to sit in an empty studio by myself while the producer, you know, asked me the questions and things over Zoom. And there were only two camera angles the entire time, one from the front, one from the side. And to make things even worse is that I had given myself a COVID haircut. So, yeah, that was the worst part of it. It was pretty bad. And I thought, well, nothing I can do about it now. So here we are. We ended up filming that shock doc and it came out. And what was funny is, or not funny, but odd, is that it was filmed about a month, almost a month to the day when Ronald Hunkler passed away. So I couldn't say anything about, I couldn't give his name. I couldn't give anybody's name other than the priests who were involved. That was it. And so then he passed away before the film even came out. So, but you know, it all kind of worked out. And
did Ronald remember much about what happened?
No, that was the interesting thing. Whenever, according to a couple of the priests that I interviewed, when they would conduct the exorcism at night, when it was over the following day, Ronald really didn't remember much of what happened. And the things that he did remember later on, they sort of faded away over time. When I interviewed him, he said, you know, I wish that I could tell you more. He said, but I just don't have clear memories of that part of what happened. He said, I can talk about my family, which he did. He said, I could talk about, you know, the priests involved and some of the places. He said, but as far as the nitty details, he said, I feel like when I hear about it, I'm hearing about someone else's life because I can't remember. I don't have any experiences of my own. But he did talk about, you know, how it had affected him because it was something that bothered him his entire life. Not that he was ashamed, but because he was always afraid that people that would find out that he was the inspiration for The Exorcist. And he worked for NASA. I mean, he was a rock, literally a rocket scientist. And so his thing was always, he didn't want his coworkers at NASA to ever find out because he just worried what they would say.
Definitely.
Well, he retired in 2001. So it was a few years before anything really started to make the rounds too much. People didn't start digging into this story until maybe the early 2000s. I mean, there was material out there, but nothing really in depth and not a whole lot that was accurate. I mean, I really had to start over with the whole thing and try to separate all the fact from the fiction, you know, and the interviews really helped me with that. I had one of the priests that I worked with on this, I interviewed him, I don't know how many times. And if it hadn't been for him, I'm not sure how I would have gotten the book done because he was just so much help. But even he wasn't there the entire time. So that kind of left me hanging too. And then I got a phone call from the family of one of the Alexian monks who was at the hospital toward the end. And he was there. I mean, he was there firsthand. He was helping to hold Ronnie down on the bed. He'd seen things happen. And so he had a lot of details to fill in on that. And I interviewed him for several days. He had cancer. He was dying. And that was one thing he wanted to do, is tell the story, because he really thought that it would help if people knew that there was evil in the world, you know, and he wanted to tell his story. And so I felt privileged to get the chance to do that with him, which was some fascinating stuff.
Yeah. When they were doing the exorcism, is he constantly like possessed and violent, or is it like things that he kind of comes and goes out of?
Well, initially it was only when they came to, when the ritual would begin. And I was going to say only at night, but that makes it sound like there's something spooky about it. The reason that the exorcism was only done at night is because the two priests and their assistant who were involved in the exorcism had to keep it secret. So they couldn't talk about it. Well, all of these guys had responsibilities during the day. So the only time they could come to the family's house or to the hospital or to the rectory where it was part of the time was at night. And it could go on. They said it would go on. It might be an hour. It might go on for 5 or 6 hours, depending on the reaction that they got. And it was during the ritual itself that Ronnie would begin to act out, at least in the beginning. Later, toward the very end, was sometimes during the daytime too, where he was attacking some of the monks, some of the things that were happening. Brother Greg, the monk that I had interviewed, told me there were times he'd come into the room, he brought in towels one day, and he said he saw something move out of the corner of his eye, and just out of reflex, he ducked. And it was good that he did, because a glass pitcher flew right over his head and shattered against the wall. This was the middle of the afternoon. Ronnie wasn't even doing anything, but yet there seemed to be activity around him. And so, you know, juries are out. I mean, there's no way I can prove that he was possessed. I mean, there's no way you can do that. Everyone who was directly involved did believe that he was. They wholeheartedly, I didn't talk to anybody. I haven't seen any report from anyone who was directly involved who said that they didn't think it was real. They honestly believed that it was. That Lutheran minister, you know, would always believe that it was just poltergeist activity in this kid's home. But I always tell people to keep in mind that, you know, he only saw what happened in Maryland. He never saw any of the stuff in St. Louis where the exorcism actually happened. No exorcism occurred in Maryland. It was just this guy observing it and the parents and family members and friends and neighbors reporting the weird stuff that they saw. So I don't ever tell people what to believe when it comes to this. I just present what I've been able to gather, and they can judge for themselves, you know, what they want to believe.
I'm curious, the man that you interviewed, he was the monk, I think, that in the hospital, who wanted the story told because he wanted people to know there's evil out there and stuff. How often do you think, because there's so many stories of demons, and when we watch these TV shows, there's so many demons and stuff, and I don't typically believe in demons too much.
I don't either.
That being said, every once in a while, like you said, like this case or something like that, there are some things where, like, well, I can't, you know, deny that that happened to him. And if that did, that's, you know, different from everything else that I'm experiencing over here. So maybe there is something to that particular case. But do you think that if there is such a thing as demons or possession or things like that, it's so incredibly rare?
Absolutely. Yeah, I don't think this is something that happens very often. In fact, I interviewed a priest who's the head of an entire state of the exorcists they have. And he says that 99% of the times they're called out to do a so-called exorcism, it's really just a blessing on the house. And it's more of infestation type things than it is like a full-blown possession. So, you know, I'm like you. I hear demons all the time on TV. And I just roll my eyes normally. But I think a lot of it has to do with what we call things depends on our background.
Yes.
And I think for these priests and for Brother Greg, I think that their background, I mean, they spent their entire life, you know, in religious service. So to them, this activity, this malevolent entity or whatever it was demonic, you know, right out of the Bible kind of thing. And yeah. I've often wondered if maybe, you know, these things things like this do happen. I mean, they are rare, but they do tend to happen. And, you know, I've spent so many years dealing with this particular story that it's led me to believe that something happened. Now, I can't tell you what it was. I don't think it was a hoax. I don't think it was mental illness. There's lots of things, and I have lots of reasons why I don't think it was those things. Now, do I think that it was, a fallen angel that came to earth with Lucifer and is out wreaking havoc? No, I don't. But I think it's possible that it could be something maybe we don't understand, or something malevolent, at least,
yeah.
You know, that's out there. And whatever you believe, that's the name you're going to give it. I mean, it doesn't matter if you want to call it a demon or an angel or a spirit or a ghost or a, you know,
elemental.
Yeah, anything. Yeah. I mean, I think it depends on your background, how it gets labeled. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've noticed is that it seems like when there are demons everywhere on a TV show, it's always people from the Northeast. It's always New England. People love their demons. I don't know why. I think it's the Puritans. I'm going to blame it on the Puritans or something. But man, they love their demons up that way. And yeah, but then you go west, you don't hear about demons all the time. You know, and so there's got to be a reason for this. You know,
what's funny too is you were talking about how the Lutheran priest was like, man, maybe it's a hoax or whatever. It's interesting because my very first experience when I was a kid, and I grew up Lutheran in the Lutheran church, like went through the whole catechism thing, confirmed
sure.
the whole church every Sunday kind of thing. When I had my first experience, I've told this story before, but the family had two different thoughts on it. One thought I needed psychiatrist, and the other said I needed to talk to our pastor at our church, who's Lutheran. And so we did both, and the pastor came, and I could tell he did not believe me, but he did give me some good advice. He told me to keep a diary and write everything down that happened.
That is good advice. Yeah.
It was great advice, but at the time I could tell he's not buying it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been my experience that Lutherans will give you a little bit of leeway when it comes to ghosts, but they don't want to hear about demons and possession and stuff. That's just not, that's a Catholic thing. You know, let the Catholics deal with that, you know?
Yeah.
That's always been my experience. And what was funny about this particular case is that Ronald's father, Edwin, was raised a Catholic. His grandmother had been a Catholic, but she became a Lutheran. So she had raised Ronnie's mother as a Lutheran. So when all this stuff first started happening in their house, they just assumed their house was haunted. That's why they called their Lutheran minister to come over, who didn't believe it was a ghost. He thought it was Ronnie playing pranks on his family, you know, until he really had some time to study this. I mean, he ended up bringing Ronnie to his home to spend the night because he had seen things happening at the Hunkler house, but wasn't buying it. He was still convinced Ronnie was up to something. So we brought him to his house to spend the night there. And he put him in the master bedroom. There were two double beds and Ronnie went to bed and Reverend Schultz stayed up to keep an eye on Ronnie. And he said that after Ronnie had gone to sleep, that the bed that he was on started shaking and banging against the wall. Yeah, so we got him up thinking he's still up to something, got him
no
up,
way.
Put him in a chair across the room. and just like an easy chair, and told him to go back to sleep. And he did. And then the Reverend sat there and watched the chair move away from the wall and dump Ronnie out on the floor.
No way.
Now, he didn't have an explanation for this. So now he just made a pallet for him on the floor and put him back down, told him to go back to sleep. And according to Reverend Schultz, as he sat there watching, that pallet Ronnie was on slid across the hardwood floor halfway across the room and went right underneath the bed that Ronnie had been sleeping on. So he still wasn't thinking, and he never did, never thought that it was anything demonic. And he didn't even think it was a ghost. He, again, thought it was just something from Ronnie. And he contacted J.B. Ryan at Duke University.
Yeah.
Because at the time, he was the top guy in the whole country dealing with this stuff in 1949. Yeah. So he contacted him, and I've got a copy of the letter where he describes the events. And Dr. Ryan was excited and said that he would come up to Cottage City, Maryland, where the families lived, to see things for himself. But by the time his schedule was clear, the family had gone on to St. Louis. So Dr. Ryan never got involved in it, but that's Reverend Schultz. Reverend Schultz always thought it was a poltergeist. In fact, when it was all over, he presented a paper in D.C. about Ronnie and the poltergeist. Never used his name, but said it was a poltergeist. But then he added that the family didn't believe that and had gone to St. Louis for an exorcism. Now, in 1949, all you had to do was say exorcism. People got really excited. And so a reporter wrote a story headlining exorcism, but then couldn't say anything, didn't know anything about it, only that it had happened. But the story got picked up all over the DC area. Everybody kept running this exorcism story without naming names or any of the details. And that's actually how William Peter Blatty found out about it. He saw that article in a paper, cut it out, thought it was interesting, and went to talk to one of his advisors and say, hey, what do you know about this? And the guy says, well, you know, rumor has it there really was an exorcism and there was a diary kept and all kinds of stuff. And of course, Blatty, you know, wanted to know if he could see any of it. And of course, he couldn't. Blatty was studying to be a priest at the time, but then he obviously didn't complete his studies. So, yeah. You know, he ended up as a writer, but and then went back to that 20 years later to write The Exorcist, you know, so it was inspired by this real story.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And speaking about studying and everything and the Rhine, I've been taking classes at the Rhine. I'm not currently at the moment taking classes, but I have been in the recent past taking classes with Lloyd Auerbach.
Sure, man. He's the best. Yeah, he's the best.
So good. Like, he just makes it so fun, too. And I just feel like he's so knowledgeable.
He is. He is a walking encyclopedia of everything you could possibly want to know about anything to do with parapsychology. And he's a lot of fun too. You know, that's the thing. He's got a great sense of humor. He's great to be around. Between him and Rosemary Ellen Guiley, who was an old friend of mine who passed away a couple of years, if I needed to know something, they were the people to ask. You could always ask. So
for sure. But he's not the first person I would take classes for. I have to tell everybody about you and I.
Yeah, I know. Man, that has been a long time ago. That has been so long.
I know. So that was back in like 2005, probably.
Probably. Yeah, at least maybe even a year or two before that.
I started taking classes. Yeah. It was online courses. And this was really early in the day of online courses. Yep. Like, they were just getting started to even do such a thing.
Right, right.
And the books that I had to read, I was taking classes for getting my paranormal investigator's certificate. And
the
books that I had to read were yours.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That was fun. That was a different time, you know, it was a whole different world back then. And online was still pretty new. And, you know, the course thing was fun and it was new. And it would always be, listen, I'm not going to make you an expert, but if you finish it, you know, at least you'll have some knowledge, you know, some common sense knowledge. That was always my thing with it. I just always wanted to push the common sense side of all of it. And I finally got out of, I put out my last edition, or it went out of print in 2010, of that Ghost Hunters guidebook, because I felt like I wasn't going to keep up with it anymore. I couldn't keep up with things that were starting to change, because it had gone from, you know, I mean, technology was changing. So it made it hard to keep trying to put out a book that kept trying to update technology. Plus, and this sounds really jaded, by that point I went, okay, it's been like 15 years of using all these gadgets and gizmos and watching them all light up. And then, you know, and then watching people wander around next to refrigerators and having them light up and things. Yeah. And I thought, what have I learned? What have I personally learned from using these devices for 15 years now? And I realized that I knew absolutely nothing more than I knew before. I had no further proof of anything that I'd ever had. And I thought, I don't think this is for me. My thing became, I was pushing people to not only use common sense, which I already mentioned, but my other thing was trying to convince people that science isn't going to prove a place is haunted. It's just not. Science isn't going to do it, because in order to prove something through science, you have to have a repeatable experiment. You have to be able to duplicate it over and over and over again, especially preferably in a laboratory setting. Well, that's not going to happen. Ghosts don't perform on command. You cannot make a ghost do what you want. So that's tough, but it's still possible to prove it. I believe that a place is haunted, okay, but it's good. Through the history, and it's through that history that you can prove it. If you take a location and you go back in time and talk to different people from different time periods who don't know each other, but who've all had the exact same experiences, how do you explain that? There's no way to explain that. And that occurred to me because of a house I got involved with. I had a woman who contacted me and said, hey, you know, I'm pretty sure my house is haunted. My husband and I, we keep waking up and we keep seeing this man standing in our bedroom at night. And he seems to know we're there. But he just, if you try to even approach him, he disappears. I said, okay, well, you know, I'll come by and check it out and you could show me and talk. We'll talk about it. So I came by, she told me all the stories of the things that they were seeing and where it was happening and stuff. So I thought I better do some research on the history of the house. Now, keep in mind, this is at the time when you had to go to the library. You had to get through all the dusty books and go through the microfiche and all this stuff you can find. And so I found information about the house. I found the history and I dated it back, and I found the original owner of the house had worked at a local bank. He had stolen a bunch of money, but nobody knew it. But there was going to be an audit at the bank and he was going to be found out. So he committed suicide at the house. And there was a photo of him in the paper. So I printed it out. And then I went and I printed out other photos from right around the same time, just other random people. And I put them all together and I went back to the house. I didn't just show her one picture. I showed her all of them. And I said, any of these guys look familiar? And she immediately pointed to the original owner of the house and said, that's the guy that's in our bedroom.
You did a ghost lineup.
I did. And she had no idea that anything about the history of the house, name, anything. Well, I ended up, as time went on, I was able to talk to some of the other people who had lived in the house before her. They also claimed they'd had experiences there. I showed them the same pictures. They all picked out the same guy. There's no way to just blow that off. You can't. It's impossible. I mean, this was an impossible situation. I mean, I know a skeptic could come up with the wildest theory as to how this could have happened, but I'm telling you, it happened, and history proved the house was haunted. And I think that you could do that with just about any building, especially when there are witnesses involved. And I think it's more reliable than just to go somewhere and go, oh, I got high EMF readings. Well, that could mean anything. There's no way to know what that means, you know? So I think that's why I just sort of became, I don't know, less interested in the gadgets. I still love to go to places, and I'll go along with people who are doing it. I'll go along on my own. I mean, my thrill is to, you know, to have an experience somewhere, which doesn't happen very often because I'm about as psychic as a fence post. But, you know, on the rare occasions when something does, it makes it all worthwhile.
I agree. Yeah, that's what I like too. I like the gadgets are fun. I like having them. I like knowing what they do. I like using them sometimes,
oh, yeah.
especially because I've talked on here before. Sometimes ghost hunting can be super boring because happens.
Right.
You can spend 2 days in a place and nothing happens. And so when you get a little flicker of the light or you get, you know, the REM pod starts going off or something, it at least gives you like some adrenaline and some excitement.
Yeah.
And I
think it's gotten a lot better too, just like you just said. I mean, you just said it in a nutshell. You know, you're using some sort of handheld device and you've got a REM pod set up and you probably got cameras and a recorder going. It didn't used to be that way. People would just walk around with a gadget and wander all over a house, not understanding how those things worked. And that if you know, move them up and down or too quickly side to side, they'd go off. It wasn't a ghost, you know, it could be a bad electrical outlet, you know, and nobody took, you know, any consideration into the fact that evidence, one piece of evidence doesn't mean anything by itself. You don't, you know, a prosecutor doesn't go into court with one piece of evidence to try to convict somebody. You've got to have corresponding evidence. So today, people are, I think, are smart enough to know that you've got to have four or five different things going at the same time. And if that picks something up, again, it's kind of like the, you know, here's the six pack of people. Do you recognize one? It's the same thing. I've got five things here showing that there's something happening. How do you dispute that? It's very, very difficult to do.
Yeah, it really is. We talked about how we did classes in the early 2000s, but your first book was in 1989. I want people to know that because you are OG.
No, 93. 93.
Oh,
I started stuff in 89, but the first book actually didn't come out till 93. Well, it was a little harder back then to write books because there were no computers. I mean, the whole thing was written on a word processor, and I'm not joking. I drew the illustrations myself and I took photographs, had them developed, and then glued them into the book. That's how it was done back then.
Yeah.
And it was all offset printing. I knew how to do a zine, right? So that's essentially what the first book was, but it was done by a printer. And I never imagined that I would sell as many of them as I did. I mean, I'm glad I did because otherwise I would not be doing this today, but I did, which was great. So I was very excited about it. The book, when I look back at it, not so exciting these days, but...
But it spawned a haunted tour, which I feel like that is OG too, like doing haunted tour. Like you had to be one of the first ones.
Yeah, there was a tour in Chicago which is kind of where I got the idea from, as far as, well, actually a buddy of mine suggested, he goes, you know, you're working on this book. He said, but when the book comes out, I'll bet people probably want to go around and see those places. He said, you ought to just rent a van or something. Well, we had no idea that anybody would really want to go. So at the time I worked at a radio station and I went to the boss there at the station. I said, hey, I got this idea. And I told him, and he said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Nobody's going to want to take a ghost tour. And I said, well, how about this? You guys get the bus and we'll give the tickets away for free. And he said, that's the only way anybody's going to go. And so we managed to get an old decommissioned city bus and we started giving away the tickets on the air. They lasted about 7 minutes. And we just kept getting phone calls. So the night of the tour, the people who had the tickets showed up to claim their seats. And the DJs had all been telling people that, you know, hey, you could always just come down to where the tour starts. And if there's anybody who doesn't show up, maybe you could get on the bus. And we had like 400 people who showed up to get on the bus. And the boss at the station said, okay, maybe this will work. Well, the next year I charged money for the tickets.
So
it kind of just turned into a thing. I mean, I'm still doing it. 20, I don't know how long is that, 30? Oh, I guess that's 30.
2 years
later, I'm still doing it.
That's what I have on here. It's the 30-year anniversary, which is so impressive. Because it turned into your company, which is the American Hauntings Tours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How many of those do you do?
Well, we have tours in Decatur, where I grew up, Illinois. We have one in Springfield, Illinois. We have one in Chicago. We have one in Alton, actually two different ones in Alton, Illinois, which is down by St. Louis. And most of them run all year round. Decatur's only at Halloween. Most of them run all year round. I do some tours, only the ones that involve food. Personally host. I don't do the other ones, but I got a great staff. Most of them have been with me for like 20 years or more. And wow. So we're just busy all the time. And then we do a lot of ghost hunts and things. And I've got staff members who go out to, and in different states who go out and host the events. And so it's just fun. You know, it's a lot of fun. So, and then I just stay here lurking in my office, writing books. So
the tours are all in Illinois.
Yes, except for our ghost hunts. We do those all over the place.
Different locations.
Just wherever locations pop up that, you know, a lot of them will invite us, they'll seek us out or we'll seek them out. And that's always interesting too. It's always fun. So,
yeah. And then you started the Haunted America Conference, right?
Yeah, that was in 97. So this is our 20, well, technically it's our 29th year, but we had to skip it in 2020. So officially it's 28 years coming up in June.
That was
funny too, because in 1997 there were no ghost conferences that didn't exist, but I got the strangest thing I got the idea because a buddy of mine ran a Sherlock Holmes conference of all things and invited me to come. And I thought, well, this will be fun. And it was not, but it was interesting anyway. And I thought, you know, we could do this with ghost stuff. I know enough, you know, people who are writing books and stuff that would love to probably come and speak. So we started doing it. And that first year, it ran the local paper. I mean, the internet was so new, but we got a lot of people that way interested in it. But the story, about 3 days before the conference, a reporter ran just a tiny little article about it in the local paper and thought the whole thing was so dumb. I mean, just, you know, nobody gets stuff, you know, and he thought the whole thing was silly. But just for fun, he put it on the AP wire and it went out. And for the 3 days leading up to the conference, I would spend between starting at about 6 a.m. through noon and then again in the afternoon, hours every day on radio stations that were calling me from all over the country because they thought this the silliest thing they'd ever heard, bunch of people getting together to hunt and talk about ghosts. And it was crazy. It was just absolutely nutty week, but it was fun. And you know, been doing it ever since. And now, I mean, we have regulars who come from, I mean, every part of the country, sometimes from out of the country to attend, that have been coming for years. You know, we look at it like it's kind of like paranormal summer camp.
Yeah.
You know, it's a chance to see your friends that you only see once a year.
Yes.
And it is a lot of fun. And, you know, nobody judges your weird beliefs or your weird ideas or anything. Everybody just kind of gets together and has fun. But yeah, it's a great time. It really is. I enjoy it so much.
Was this the first one?
The very first ghost conference. In the country, anyway. I don't know beyond here, but in America, it was. Yeah,
nobody so many
tried
now.
It before. Now there's a lot. Yeah, but yeah, there's just it was just. I don't know. I just thought it'd be fun, you know, and it was.
Yeah.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it. That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
Well, one of the reasons that, I mean, obviously I would have wanted you on this podcast no matter what, because there's so many things to talk about. But one of the reasons that I contacted you right now, and I did, is I just had on Tammy Merhab Chavez. Are you familiar with her? She has a podcast called Hollyweird.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I know the name. I don't know her, but yeah, I do know the name. Yeah.
So I just had her on my podcast. I love to do everything themed. And so I wanted to do a whole Mardi Gras episode, and she's from New Orleans. So I had her on, and we were talking about New Orleans ghost stories, and it was really fun and everything. And one of the things, I research everybody's episode before I do it and like come up with stories and ideas and topics and everything. And when I was researching New Orleans ghosts, one of the things that I found on there was the New Orleans axe murderer back in like the early 1900s. And I thought, oh my God, I haven't heard about this. So I was doing a little bit of research on it and talked about it. I was like, oh, I'm going to ask Tammy about this. And then when she came on, I was asking her about it. And we just briefly talked about it. Neither one of us know a great deal of details on it or anything. And then all of a sudden I was like, you know what? I wonder if that has anything to do with Villisca. Wouldn't that be around the same time? But as I'm talking to her live, like I couldn't remember even when Villisca happened. So she was like, you know, I think Troy Taylor just did a podcast about that. And I was like, wait, what? And so I went and she sent me the link and I was like, oh my God, he did like a whole series on this. I have to have him on to come and talk about this. And I purposely did not listen to your series because I wanted to be like a listener on here that most likely has no knowledge of any of this. So can you fill us in a little bit and see if they're connected?
Well, I don't think that the New Orleans Axeman and Villisca are connected just because of the time difference in it and the situation. None of the evidence really matches. None of the methods really match. And there were some other axe murders that happened too before Villisca that also I believe were all connected, but they were down in Louisiana and Texas, and that's all. The Villisca murders were almost the end of what I believe is a spree. I first started looking into Villisca, I guess, mid-2000s, I guess. I had gone out and visited the house for the first time and had spent the night there. And I've been there. I've lost track of how many times I've been there.
Really?
But the last owners of the house, the ones who had turned it into the kind of museum that it became, I got to know them really well. And so I went out a lot. And that in itself was interesting. But when I started doing some research into the Villisca murders, I kept thinking, you know, I wonder, this just seemed like it was so easy for this guy to, okay, well, let me back up and give you a nutshell story on what happened to Villisca.
Yeah.
It was June 9th, 1912. There was a family who lived in this town. J.B. Moore, Sarah Moore was his wife. They had four kids, and then they had a couple of young girls who were friends of their daughters who were spending the night with them that night. And they had gone to a Sunday school program. Sarah was the head of the Sunday school in town at their church. So they went to the Sunday school program. They went home, and at some point during the night, it's believed the killer was already hiding in their attic, that he'd gotten into the house. Now, this is a tiny house. And the attic is not what you might expect. The attic is not above everything. It's actually on the second floor of the house. It's just a unfinished room that the family did not use because it's small and it was kind of cramped. There are two bedrooms upstairs and one bedroom downstairs. At the time, no running water in the house. There was a pump that pumped water in, but no bathroom or anything. So it was not a big place. It was just a parlor, kitchen, one bedroom downstairs, and then the stuff upstairs. Well, at some point during the night, the killer left the attic, murdered JB and Sarah first in the master bedroom, which is the main bedroom at the top of the stairs, then murdered their four children in the middle of the night, hit everyone with the blunt side of an axe, went downstairs and killed the two visiting girls as well, and stayed in the house for a while. He stayed there. He washed up in the kitchen, made himself a sandwich. And then he had already covered all of the curtains or covered all of the windows. He closed all the curtains, and then the curtains that didn't have windows, he'd gotten clothing out of the closets and hung them over so that no one could see that there was a light in the house. At least that's my theory behind it, because he left behind a lantern that, or an oil lamp that he had turned the wick down really far. He'd taken the top glass off, and so there was barely any light to see by, but that's apparently all he needed once his eyes adjusted. Anyway, committed the murders, locked other doors, and left. Well, the next morning, the neighbor noticed that the cows hadn't been milked at the Moore house and that all the curtains were closed and nobody was up around moving, which is very strange when you've got four kids at home and you're, you know, you've got a cow, you've got chickens, you've got a husband who runs a very popular farm implement store in town, as JB did. She called JB's brother to come down and check the house because she thought something was wrong. That's when the bodies were discovered. So this murder became the biggest in Iowa history. I mean, there'd been nothing like it. Eight people killed in one house in one night in 1912. And this is a small town. And, you know, they didn't know how to investigate it. You know, they didn't know to keep people out of the crime scene. People were wandering around, picking things up, carrying it away. You know, they brought in bloodhounds trying to catch the killer, thinking that he was somebody from town. The killer was long gone by then. Well, anyway, so I started to think, you know, man, this guy so easily got away with this. And he left these really strange things behind, like the curtains and the wick on the chimney, on the light and everything. And I thought, so odd. I wonder if maybe he'd done this before. So I started digging back through newspapers, which is a lot easier than it was when I wrote my first book. even in 2005, it was easier. Started digging back through old newspapers and found that for months ahead of the Villisca murders, there had been a string of other murders across the Midwest that were identical. Identical. I mean, wow. How the killer got in the house,
even the
what
lantern?
He left behind, the lantern in every single case had left the wick burning. The bodies were posed. He covered the corpses. He covered the windows. I mean, it was to a T matching. And there were several of them. Colorado Springs, Illinois, Kansas, a couple of places in Kansas. And then just shortly before Villisca, there had been another attack in Kansas where two people were killed. And then the house nearby was broken into. And whoever the intruder was that same night was scared away. Well, 3 days later, Villisca happened, which now today we can look at that and go, well, that's serial killer behavior. You know, he couldn't do what he wanted to do. And, you know, he needed to release that tension. And then Villisca happened. There was one other murder that happened after Villisca, identical, same exact stuff. And then they stopped. Now, why they stopped, nobody knows. I mean, it could be a variety of things. But one thing that I will tell you that put all of the towns where the murders happen in common, they were all connected by the railroad. So this guy either worked for the railroad or was traveling by railroad, which was pretty common at the time. I mean, hobos were all over the place riding the rails. And so this is, I believe that's how this guy was traveling. A few years later, after, I guess, probably 8 years or so after my book came out, Bill James put out a book called The Man on the Train and referenced me a lot in it because the theory, I mean, they tied a lot of murders that I don't think fit. I think this was a series of murders, but a small one. It wasn't dozens and dozens. I think it was a handful of murders, but they were the only ones where the modus operandi matched perfectly. And so that, I think, is obviously the reason the house is haunted. There are stories of hauntings connected to a couple of the other places. But the problem is that only one of the other houses today still survive. Only one in Monmouth, Illinois, where murders happen, and then Villisca. And Villisca, of course, has got its reputation for it's haunting. I consider it one of the most haunted places in America. But I think a lot of people who live nearby, and this was always the case of the folks I knew who owned the place, they always believed the killer was local because I've got a lot of theories on why they wholeheartedly believe that, even though it really doesn't fit. I think it's a lot easier to think that you've got a killer at home than just some boogeyman showing up out of nowhere, slaughtering a local family and disappearing again. But you have no chance to catch. If you could prove some local guy did it, that's going to make you feel a whole lot better. So a detective they hired tried to pin it on a local senator who lived in town. And the community finally decided that it probably was this weird little traveling minister that was a window peeper and just a complete nut. They decided it was him, but he was put on trial twice and he couldn't have committed the murders, but he was nuts. There's no question about that, but he couldn't have committed the murders. It just didn't fit. But he was the only person ever tried for it, you know, but nobody could ever figure out, you know, what happened. And to this day, the Axeman who committed those murders, I think got away with it. I just don't think they were equipped to handle a serial killer in 1912. Yeah. They just weren't.
Doesn't it just make you nuts that somebody got away with that? Like somebody did all of that and they never have to. I mean, maybe it's the Libra in me, but I'm just like outraged that they were able to get away with this.
I know. I have a list, as you can imagine from my job, I have a list of things I need to know when I die.
Yes.
That is the top of my list. And you know, it's going to turn out to be a name that I've never heard because there weren't any real solid suspects. So yeah. I'm not going to have known that. I'm not going to hear the name and go, oh, I should have known because I don't know who he was. Yeah. You know, there were lots of theories. I mean, a lot of people agreed with me that it was the traveling killer. Policemen at the time agreed with this idea, but they weren't any closer to figure out who it was either. And they didn't understand serial killers back then, you know.
We need to know who Jack the Ripper is.
Oh, absolutely. And I need to know who killed the Black Dahlia. So that's another one I'm going to need to know.
And that's going to end up.
Well, that one. Hey, listen, don't get me started on Lizzie Borden. We're going to be here for another hour because I've been able to prove, seriously, I proved in my book that Lizzie Borden could not have committed those murders. Could not have.
But the she time did some weird things.
Does the, oh, yes, she did some weird things because she knew who did it, but she didn't swing the axe. Now, that's not to say she wasn't involved, because I really think she was, but she didn't carry out the murder. Honestly, there just wasn't time because there was such a very short amount of time between when she was last seen and when the alarm was raised about the murders. And for her to have done it, she would have had to strip off all of her clothes, which took some time back then anyway, but would have had to strip off all of her clothes, commit the murders, be covered. Well, first she would have had to kill her stepmother, and then an hour later kill her father too. And in between those, she would have had to change her clothes, washed all the blood off somehow, even though there was no water, no bathroom in the house, no bathtub in the house. The only water was a spigot in the basement. So in order to take a bath, they had to have water hauled out of the basement and up to a bathtub. So she'd have had to gone down to the basement somehow, washed all the blood off without anyone finding out or leaving any trace of blood behind, would have hadn't gotten redressed, spoke to the maid and her father, then send the maid to take a nap for about 15 minutes is all the longer she was in her bedroom before the alarm was raised. She would have had to have stripped off her clothes again, murdered her father, then gone back down to the basement, washed up again, got redressed, and then be in the dress that everyone had seen her wearing already throughout the day, which had no blood on it. So there's just no time. There's no time.
I thought her dress did have like stains of red on it.
It had four spots on it that were inside the dress, which she claimed was menstrual blood, which makes more sense than being covered in blood, which she would have been. She struck both of her parents in the head. Now, you know, head wounds bleed. And there was blood everywhere. I mean, there's blood all over the murder room. So there's no way she couldn't have gotten blood all over her so that she would have had to have washed off. And if she was wearing that same dress that had four spots of blood on it, that makes no sense either because she would have been covered in it. So
yeah.
If I had the notes in front of me, I could give you an exact time, minute by minute. I break the whole thing down minute by minute. And I went to the house and walked that same amount of time to do all of the things that she had to have done. And there's no way it could have been done. There's just not. So, but I would love to know if I'm right. Because what if I'm wrong? You know, I believe I'm right, but what if, you know? Right. Or at least I want to know if I think who did it actually did it. So,
can you say who you think did it, or is it
no, if I do, no one will read my book. That's why I won't do a podcast about it.
Okay. Wait, is the book out?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 Okay. It came out a few years ago. So,
okay.
It's called One August Morning. So, yeah.
But, yeah.
But I love that story, but I agree with you. That's another one that I need to know too.
Yeah. So. There's so many. Like, if I thought about it longer, I'd have like a bunch more. I mean, JonBenet, I need to know.
Oh, yeah. There's so many. I know. And I'm hoping that someday, you know, well, you don't want to hope for when you're going to die, but when I do die, these are things on my list.
So. Yeah, you're like, wait, I have a whole list of stuff I need to know now.
Excuse me, wait a minute. Yeah, I'm going to need, and then I'm going to go back because I want to be a ghost, but I got to hear this stuff first. So.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Well, speaking of some of the books you've written, I have a list here that you've written books on New Orleans, Abraham Lincoln, Villisca, Murder in Washington, D.C., Lizzie Borden, H.H. Holmes, which I'm fascinated by that whole story too.
Yeah.
Illinois ghost stories, Missouri ghost stories, cults and disasters, America's graveyards, haunted mines, tunnels and caverns, the Black Dahlia, weirdness on Route 66. That sounds like fun. Haunted hotel rooms, unsolved disappearances and vanishing. And I said it when I was reading your bio too. I'm like, this is everything I love. All of
Well, I mean, that's that. How do you, it's like people ask me, well, what do you decide what to write about? Well, whatever I want. You know, I mean, I have this big list of things that I want to write books about. And I've got, and then I hate when I have a contract that's going to interrupt me just writing about whatever I want. I don't like to have something that I have to have done at a certain time. Yeah. Sometimes I do, but I don't like it. I just want it to be about whatever. So.
I don't write books. I'm trying to write my own like Playboy memoir right now, but yeah. I know what you mean. Like you have to really, like you can't just be like, I'm going to write my book today or on Wednesday this week. You have to actually like feel it inside, feel inspired and have words that are like coming to you.
Well, there's nothing that I like doing more. I hate the days when I have to get ready for an event or work on a website or something. And I can't just write because that's all I really want to do is just write and write and write. And I don't know. It's what I enjoy the most. And I'm glad that, you know, I started out as a writer and then started doing tours and events. But, you know, sometimes the tours and events are what supports me being allowed to just write about any random thing I want to write about, you know?
Yeah,
so
definitely. But how did you, I'm sure I asked you the last time I had you on, but what got you into the paranormal?
When I was a kid, my great grandfather was a cop in the town where I grew up, and I was young. He was still alive. He was older by then, but was still around. And he was an Irish immigrant, and he was full of stories and would tell me all the stories, not only about all of the terrible crimes that happened and all the murder scenes that he witnessed. Keep in mind, I'm like eight, but he would tell me about all the ghost stories and all the weird experiences he'd had as a cop, you know, with ghosts and a guy he knew who was murdered. And he thought that he'd seen his ghost, and he just filled my head full of that stuff. So as I grew up, I mean, I've always been fascinated with all of it, you know, and I just, you know, I had an unusual family. I mean, I spent some summers in the carnival with some of my uncles and, you know, and so you start mixing all that stuff together and wanting to be a writer since I was a little kid. I mean, I still remember when my mother bought me my first typewriter in like junior high, which was a game changer, you know, and, I've never really wanted to do anything else. And so that's just what I've always done. And then the, you know, the tours kind of grew out of that. And then, you know, I started doing events and, you know, I do dinners and stuff. And then last year I opened an oddities museum, mostly just filling it full of stuff from my house. You know, I just collected some, I have so many interests, and, you know, I've got, you know, spiritualism stuff and Ouija boards and talking slates and all that kind of stuff. And I've got tons of true crime memorabilia and you know, and I got lots and lots of circus and sideshow stuff, banners and, you know, photos and the trade cards they used to hand out and funeral stuff. And I just, what am I going to do with all this stuff? Nobody ever sees it, you know? And so finally I thought, you know what? I'm going to follow my dream and open a museum. So now I got a museum and it's fun. I mean, it's just fun. It's another outlet for me to get to do stuff that I love doing. You know, I get to put together exhibits and it's just, you know, decorate them the way I want and put in the stuff I want and, you know, write up all the information for people to discover. You know, it's just, it's a blast, you know? And so,
yeah.
I don't know. I'm just like a kid in a candy store. That's my life. I mean, I just do what I want to do, you know, and do a podcast. I mean, it's just, you know, 100 things, but I wouldn't change anything about it. You know?
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. So,
but it's fun when you have like all these different things, because then you don't get sick of doing one thing.
I never get bored.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Nothing's ever boring. I never get tired of what I do or where I'm doing it. And I get to, you know, be a kid, you know, I get to do stuff that most people grow out of. And I just never did, you know?
Yeah. So. Where's your museum?
It's in Alton, here in Alton, Illinois.
Okay.
It's in an old haunted hotel. I took over the ballroom of the hotel, and it's just called the American Oddities Museum. And we're open every weekend, and we usually get 100-150 people come through every weekend, which isn't a lot, but it's growing. You know, more and more come. I think we'll see even more this summer than last, which is great. You know, it's just it's fun. It's a fun place.
Yeah, for sure. Do you get to travel quite a bit for your work?
Yeah. I tend to travel for fun a lot of times, just because I want to go someplace that I, you know, haven't been, or go back to someplace that I've been a zillion times, like New Orleans, where I just, you know, love to go every year. But yeah, and I do travel some. I do TV guest things sometimes and stuff. So I'll travel when I do that kind of stuff. But I get to travel as much as I want to, pretty much. And I just, mostly because I'm so entertained by what I do at home that I don't have those desperate urges, but I do like to go. So I go whenever I can. Yeah.
Yeah. So. Have you investigated or done any research here in Los Angeles or California?
Here and there. Yeah. I mean, I've been to places there over the years. I was there last year, but only for a couple of days, and hopefully I'll get back again, sometime in the near future, because I always enjoy coming out there, and I'm a little heartbroken, as I'm sure you are too, with all of the things that were lost in the fires recently.
Yes.
The history that was destroyed, Will Rogers Ranch, you know, Thelma Todd's cafe is still there, but the house and the garage where she died is gone. And she's always been one of my favorite. That's always been one of my favorite stories, you know, with what happened when she died and things. But also she was just always one of my favorite, you know, old time early comedian. She was so funny, and I just love her. And I, you know, I was watching, trying to keep an eye on to see where the fires were going, because it's just, I mean, not just the people who are currently losing all their homes, but the history that was lost because of them is just terrible, terrible. Mm-hmm. So
it really is. What about Queen Mary? Have you been there?
I have been there. I have a friend who's like, man, she's like an expert on Queen Mary. So it was a lot of fun. Her name's Nicole Strickland. She's written a couple of books, and
she speaks.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. So Nicole. So yeah, I mean, I couldn't pass it up. I mean, you know, when you know somebody, you know, between there and San Diego too, there's a couple of my favorite spots, you know, outside of LA, but yeah, no, I love the area. I really do.
What about Winchester House?
Yeah, I visited there a couple of times. I'm unfortunately one of those people who tends to debunk the Sarah Winchester story, because this woman is pretty unfairly presented as this crazy woman who thought she was being chased by ghosts. And, you know, that whole thing got started as a way to make her look like she wasn't the genius that she was. I mean, this was a woman who was really an unschooled, untaught architectural genius. Yeah. And people have turned her gift into something that it wasn't and turned it into a spook house. And that was never the case. I did a podcast about the real story of Sarah Winchester. And I had a lot of people who wrote to me afterward and thanked me, but then told me how bummed they were. Because they wanted to believe it was just this house built by ghosts, but it really wasn't.
There's still a paranormal element to it.
I'm not saying that the house has not become haunted. I mean, that certainly can happen. There have been enough people who passed away in that house and things that it certainly could be haunted. But the story of it being built because of seances where she was given the plans by ghosts and she thought that she was cursed and would die if she quit building, none of that, unfortunately, is true. I mean, there's records that exist to show that she stopped for months and years at a time. And, you know, I just feel like that story takes away from the fact of what a genius she was. And that's what I wish people knew better, you know, that side of the story.
Well, and she was a philanthropist too. She wasn't just like this rich woman, like that never left the house that
crazily spending money. Right. Right. You know, she was a bit of a recluse because of her rheumatoid arthritis, which made it almost impossible for her to use her hands. And she had lost so many of her teeth because of her arthritis. So she would go out, she'd always wear a veil because she was embarrassed. And it had nothing to do with her being crazy. It had to do with the fact that she just didn't want people to see what had happened to her because of her chronic illness. Yeah. And so there's a lot to the story, and it's worth digging into. I mean, the story of her real life is just as fascinating to me as, in fact, it's even better than what people made up. But I mean, the house is fascinating. It's just not what it was turned into, because I mean, you know who bought the house after she died, right? Carnival guys. So of course they lied about everything, you know, that's the way it worked, you know, and that's the whole genius of the carnival, is to make it what you want it to be. And that's what these guys did, you know, and they turned it into an attraction, you know, which it is, and it has become one. But yeah,
it's
unfortunately
incredible just to see, like, just
absolutely.
It's amazing. And I did have a paranormal experience there.
Did you? Did you really? Yeah.
I was filming there late at night. And so it was just us, the film crew and myself and the PR person from the house. And I was doing this scene where I had to keep going in and out of the front door. And I went to open the door and I opened it and something pulled it right out of my hand.
And opened it or closed it?
Closed it.
Oh, closed it on you. Well, that's
I was about to go back out.
Oh, all right, all right.
And it pulled out of my hand and slammed
shut. Didn't want you to leave.
No, and I thought it was because we were kind of doing a gag where I walk in and the door just closes behind me mysteriously, you know, on its own.
Right.
And so we had a producer that was down there like closing it behind me. And so I thought, oh, it was just the producer and he doesn't realize I'm trying to come back out. But then I turned it and opened it and there was nobody there. And he was around the corner hiding from the cameras still. I was like, did you just grab the door? And he was like, no.
How did you
here.
Do that? Oh, wow. Yeah, that's cool. That is very cool.
And I definitely, like, I was down this hallway, like there's where her coach is, there's kind of this long hallway and her coach is parked at the end of it. And I was dressed like Sarah Winchester and I had a veil on and stuff. And I had the black morning dress and I had like a candelabra in my hand and I was way down by the coach and the cameras, I can see them, but they're way down at the other end of the hall and I'm waiting for them to tell me action, you know?
Right.
And I just got this very, very creepy feeling. And it was just a feeling, but it almost felt like something was going to whisper in my ear. Like something was just like right there.
Yeah. Yeah. That definitely would get your attention. So for sure. Yeah.
Okay. I just have some roundup questions and I'll let you go.
Okay. All right.
Scariest paranormal place you have ever been?
Bellwitch Cave in Tennessee. Mm. I spent the night there in 1997. They had not yet stopped letting people spend the night there. But I got to spend the night in the cave. It was very scary. And I've always thought that place was genuinely something. Whether it's the actual spirit of the Bell Witch or something else, that place is crazy haunted. Mm. And that was not a place that like I said, I don't go around seeing dead people and talking to ghosts, but that was a place that I would not do it again. I wouldn't spend the night there again. No, it is too much. It was too much. Yeah.
The only thing I've heard about that place is that you could take your car there and like put it in neutral and it'll start like, I don't know, backing up or moving forward or something.
There are a lot of stories about the neighborhood and the area around it, but the cave itself is the only part or the only thing left except for the Bell family graveyard that actually goes back to the story of the witch, which she was really a ghost. It was just something they called them in the early 1800s. And this thing haunted this family for years. And eventually it led to the death of John Bell, the father of the family. The ghost took credit for killing him, which is the only time that's ever happened in American history. It's an interesting story. Now, how much of the hard facts made it from 1820 till today is hard to say, but that story's been around for, 200 years. And it's a scary story. And that cave that is on that property is a scary spot. Take my word for it.
Wow. Is it a park now? Is it a national park?
No. It's privately owned and they do offer tours of the cave. So you can visit there.
I don't know why I thought it was like there. A state
park or something. Yeah. No, I mean, there are a lot of them that are, but that particular one is privately owned and it is a spot where you can take the tour and see it. So,
interesting. Yeah. I gotta go there.
Yeah, it's worth it.
Okay, favorite. I know we talked about how we feel about paranormal tools earlier, but if you had to pick one, your favorite paranormal tool beside yourself.
Oh, yeah. I would probably have to say the one I get the most enjoyment out of watching are those REM pods. Those are fun to watch because it's hard to just kind of brush off anything that happens because you leave it stationary. And that was one of those things that I was preaching a long time ago. Stop carrying this stuff around, leave it where something's supposed to happen. And with a REM pod, you can't carry it around. You have to leave it stationary. And so that has always been one that I've been the most interested in. I've seen a few blips here and there on them. Probably the one time that I really saw something I could not explain. I was at the old Lake County Jail in Crown Point, Indiana, the jail that Dillinger had escaped from. Okay. And spending the night there and had that set up in one of the cells. And literally just a few of us were there watching it. And all of a sudden, this thing just kept going off. No explanation, no one near it. And that was impressive. So that would be my favorite.
That happened to Holly and I too. We had it on the Queen Mary and we were in a suite. So it had like a living room area and a bedroom separate. And we put the REM pod in the bedroom and we were out in the living room and we were trying to do like a live podcast and stuff. It would not stop going off in the other room nonstop to the point where we had to just go and turn it off.
Yeah. And there's no explanation for it. If there's no one there, tell me what's happening. Give me some skeptical, I don't know what it is. I don't know how you rationalize something like that when it's not moving and there's no one near it and yet it's still picking something up.
It happen a second time, totally different REM pod, but I was at Tombstone and we put it on one of the graves in Tombstone, Arizona, and it would not stop to the point where they're like, can you just turn it off because we can't
We can't do anything here. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's cool. Very cool.
I think that's really cool. Okay. Do you feel like you've captured evidence before?
As far as photographs or something like that, there was one I took in, 1998, I think. I kept getting these reports from this cemetery out in the middle of nowhere and had gone out there to film some stuff. And, there was no reason for the cemetery to be haunted or anything like that. But for some reason, these photographs we kept getting were so bizarre that I couldn't explain them. I even had the negatives and things sent away to see if someone could explain it. And I had this photo of what looked like a kind of a swoop shape. And then probably 5 feet from the camera, there was a rounded white, just pure white with like eyes. And it just looked like a face. And I never could figure that one out. I never could explain it. I tried everything I could to figure out, tried to duplicate it, tried to figure out what it was. Like I said, I sent it away. It was used in a documentary. They sent it to some photo experts and they're like, yeah, we don't know what this is. We can't figure it out. So I think that was probably my favorite thing that I've ever captured. I mean, I've seen some really cool stuff over the years that I don't have easy explanations for, but that as far as for me, that was something that I've certainly never forgotten.
So. Yeah. Do you carry anything to protect yourself?
No. I keep thinking, you know, if there's, I don't know. I just figure that, you know, hey, that'll be an experience too. So if something happens, you know, possesses me or something, I guess I'll have a book to write about it. But no, I don't. I've never been that. That's one of those things that I think is a personal choice for people. And I don't discourage people from doing it, but I certainly never encourage it. And it's not something that I do myself.
No. Same. So. Okay. Paranormal place you haven't been yet, but are dying to go to.
Oh gosh. I need to get out of the country. I think at this point, although I would love, even though I've been there, I would love to spend the night on Alcatraz.
Oh yeah.
Stay there overnight. That would be that's my like one bucket list item that I don't know that I'll ever get to do, but I really want to. That's something that I would, if I get the chance, I'll let you know, because it's one of those things that I just think would be the coolest place to actually stay. And I've stayed in, you know, I've been in, you know, I don't know how many other prisons also haunted, but not Alcatraz, you know, yeah. And that's, to me, that's like the granddaddy of all of them, you know, no matter how cool Eastern State is or, you know, the Ohio Reformatory, that's the place that I really want to go, but.
Yeah.
So that's what's on my list. So.
Oh, that would be fun. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing the show today,
sharing
all your stories. Tell everybody listening how they can buy your books, take your tours, go to your museum, follow you on social media, all the stuff.
The best place to do or place to go is to go to my main website, which is just AmericanHauntings.net. And that's links to books, the conference, the museum, shows that I'm on currently that are on Netflix or whatever, and everything is right there. So it's one stop for everything. That'll take you anywhere you're going to need to go.
I was on your website and there are so many fun tours and like ghost investigations and dinners on there. I was like, damn.
Yeah. Keeps me busy. You know, it's a lot of fun.
Well, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode of the Ghost Bunny Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me on my spooky adventures, and I look forward to sharing a new ghost story with you each week. Please subscribe to our podcast so you're always the first to know when a new episode is out, and follow me on social media at Ghost Bunny Podcast on Instagram and at Ghost Bunny Podcast on YouTube. Bye, guys.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.